BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. Here's round one. Try and test their vocabularies. 2 marks if they can get the meaning of these words approximately right. We begin with Dillis Powell. Dillis, what is a hobbledehoy? Hobble and D and hoy. Hobbledehoy.
It's a kind of awkward character. And
yes.
I think a hobbledehoy is a kind of boy who's rather awkward.
That'll do. Awkward youth, midway between boyhood and manhood. Hobbledehoyish being the kind of behaviour he's supposed to have. Dennis Norton, what is a dramaturge? D-R-A-M-A-T-U-R-G-E. Dramaturge or dramaturge.
You know what an urge is, Jack.
Yes?
Well, if you don't know, perhaps you can remember. A dramaturge is a man who has an urge to write a turgid drama. Playwright, dramatist.
Quite right. It means, from the Greek, somebody who works in drama, just like a metallurgist is somebody who works in metal. Only tougher. Anne Scott James, what is lentitude? L-E-N-T-I-T-U-D-E. Lentitude.
N-T. I should think it's slowness.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Sluggishness or slowness from the Latin lentus, slow. Well done, 2 marks. Frank Muir, the meaning of the word twit. T-W-I-T.
Thank you. Twit. The Tunbridge Wells Institute of Tattooing. It's 50% of what an owl says. To twit means to chaff.
Yeah. I think that'll do. I daren't ask for any more, I don't think.
When I walked in, all the chaps twitted me.
That's it. Yes, you've got your coat on backwards. Upbraiding, reproaching, or taunting somebody because of some mistake or some fault that he's made. Well, before we start the second round, I give each team a quotation, and they write it down if they want. And I want the 2 women members of the team to study their quotations, because at the end of the programme I shall ask them where those quotations come from. So, Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, here's your quotation. Healing is a matter of time. Healing is a matter of time. And Anne Scott James and Dennis, yours is, I dream of Jeannie with the light brown hair. And then at the end of the programme I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these quotations came to be spoken or written. Well, round two is a round of mythology. 2 marks if you get these right. Dillis Powell, who seduced and abducted Helen of Troy, and what was the result?
Paris.
Paris it is. And the result?
All that war, Trojan, and the Iliad.
Yes, and the Iliad, and lots of things. Quite right. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, who used to swim the Hellespont every night to see whom?
Wait a minute, because they've got their names the wrong way round.
Yes.
It was Leander.
Yes.
Who was the man in question, who used to swim it to see Hero, who was the girl. I don't know why she was called. I think their parents must have wanted a boy. And she used to hang a lamp from her battlements.
Yes.
One night the light went out, as it does. It was blown out with the wind. Lord Byron also swam the Hellespont.
Yep, quite right, he did, yes. Oh, well done. 2 marks you get. Leander, who lived at Abydos on one side of the Straits Dardanelles, had this beloved called Hera. The girl lived at Sestos in a tower, and there was, as Dennis says, this light lantern she hung up as a sort of guide light. And one night it was blown out by the wind, and he drowned, perished miserably, and she threw herself off her tower next morning when he didn't turn up, and was drowned too. Sad little story. Anne Scott James, What were the centaurs? C-E-N-T-A-U-R-S. Centaurs.
Well, the centaurs were half men and half beasts.
Which half?
Oh, the top half was men, and the bottom half was horse, and they lived, I think, in Thessaly, if I remember right.
Yes, quite right.
And very wild packs of men beasts and men horses they were.
That'll do, I think, very well. Yes, this was a fabulous race of creatures who had horses' four legs and most of the horse's body, but also on top of that, as it were, there was standing up in front was the human body and the arms and the head, and they were tended to be rather particularly fond of wine and women, and they were always fighting with surrounding tribes in consequence. They lived on Mount Pelia in Thessaly. Two barks. Frank Muir, who was Pygmalion's sister? Pygmalion then murdered his sister's husband, and so she fled to North Africa and there founded the city of Carthage.
Please may I be excused.
It's been a funny kind of a day.
Dido.
No, Dido is the thing that goes on the top of the wallpaper.
Is it that? I think
it's Dido. It's Dido, Jack.
Dido it is. She
founded Carthage.
Founded Carthage. One story is that she then killed herself because the rather tough barbarian king wanted to marry her. But later on, when Virgil wrote, she was supposed to have killed herself because her lover Aeneas ran away from her. Two marks. Well, the next round is origins and derivations of words and expressions and phrases. Three marks if members of the team can first of all say what the present meaning is and then give the origin or derivation. Beginning with Dillis Power, your word is spinster.
A spinster means an unmarried woman.
And originally?
Actually, it's meant somebody who spent her time spinning.
But
she had
what?
Not a husband. She had to fill in the time somehow.
That's all quite accurate as far as it goes, Dillis, but...
she didn't go any further.
Why was this important? I mean...
She had to spin her trousseau.
That's it. Absolutely right. Three marks it is. Spinster nowadays, a woman who is unmarried, but in early English times, the women in winter, there wasn't much else to do, spun the fleeces, which were taken from the sheep in summer, and it was a normal job, and as Dillis quite rightly says, no woman of that period was considered to be fit for marriage until she'd spun for herself the whole lot of her own clothing and table and what we should call bed linen nowadays, and the job is usually given to the unmarried women of the household, spinners or spinsters. You find it in Twelfth Night, the spinsters and the knitters and the sun and the free maids that weave their thread with bones. Do you used to sing it? Dennis Norden, all moonshine.
Rather a lot of rubbish, nonsense. Not to be believed.
Yeah. Why?
It means that there's not much shine from the moon, I think.
Yes.
And therefore it's not to be trusted.
Yes, and why isn't there much shine from the moon?
Because it's reflected.
It's reflected, and you bring in the ionosphere and Appleton, Appleton's layer and all that stuff that I dozed through during school hours.
All moonshine means something which is not the real thing, which is false. And the reason is that moonshine itself is not the real thing, because the moon doesn't shine at all. It only reflects the light of the sun. And so an incredible statement, coming at second hand, as it were, is said to be a lot of moonshine. Anne Scott James, he's shot his bolt.
He's shot his bolt, it means he's produced all he's going to produce. Mm-hmm. He's had it. Mm-hmm. His effort is spent.
Yes.
And now, a bolt, as we all know, is a very early form of medieval arrow. Oh, it's the last arrow in the quiver. So when he shot the bolt, which as we all ask toxophilists know, is the last arrow in the quiver, then he has nothing left to shoot with.
Good enough. As Anne quite rightly says, when chap had got rid of all his bolts, it meant that he couldn't attack or counterattack anymore, and he was finished. Now back to Frank Muir. Sardonic smile or sardonic laughter?
Sardonic smile means a kind of ironic smile.
Yes.
And it's connected with Sardinia.
Yes.
Because in Sardinia, the type of maquis which is rather like alum. And when you eat it, it makes you go... and sort of shrinks up your face.
Yes, that'll do. 3 marks. A mocking smile, not expressing any real merriment. And Frank is quite right. It's a word, sardonios, first used by Homer, and probably referred to this poisonous plant which grew in Sardinia, or may still grow there, I don't know. And those who ate it certainly grinned very widely, but normally died immediately afterwards. Convulsive laughter ending in death. As a matter of fact, the derivation is a bit dubious. It may simply, quite simply come from a Greek word, sarin, meaning to grin. Well, the next round is the who, why, and what department. 2 marks again, if they get them right. Iris Bauer, who wrote about what? That it was a grain which in England is generally given to horses, but in Scotland supports the people.
Porridge, oats.
Yes, oats. And by whom?
Said by, sounds like Johnson.
Yes, it was.
Dr. Johnson.
Quite right. Samuel Johnson, in his dictionary definition of the word oats, said this, a grain which in England is generally given to horses, but in Scotland supports the people. And he realised afterwards he had been a bit naughty in that definition and said, I own that by my definition of oats, I meant to vex them. That is, the Scots. He was always trying to vex the Scots. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, in what book by what author does the character Mr. Scaramanga appear?
Oh, wait a minute. That's the last Ian Fleming book.
Yes. Title?
The Man with the Golden Thingamajig. Man with the Golden Gun.
Quite right.
Rather second-rate sort of villain, actually.
Scaramanga is, I think, the man with the golden gun himself and is the villain of the piece. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, who wrote of what when he wrote these words? It is the only art in which the artist is in danger of death and in which the degree of brilliance in the performance is left to the fighter's honour.
I say.
Yeah.
Bullfighting?
Yes. And by?
Hemingway?
Yes, quite right. 2 marks, you get it. Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway, talking of bullfighting in his book Death in the Afternoon. Frank Noah. It ennobled our hearts and enriched our blood. Our soldiers were brave and our courtiers were good.
Beer?
No, more solid than beer.
Beef?
Beef?
Yes.
Beef.
Which beef?
Which beef? Well, you know, the bull. We've just killed, is naturally slaughtered.
English beef.
The roast beef of old England.
Yes,
of course.
Your friend Henry Fielding came into this. It was the roast beef of old England. Richard Leveridge, in the 18th century, wrote these particular lines I've quoted. It ennobled our hearts and enriched our blood. Our soldiers were brave and our courtiers were not good, but good. But Henry Fielding in the Grub Street Opera says much the same thing. Oh, the roast beef of old England and oh, the old English roast beef. Now, the next round refers to our experiences when we travel on the continent. For 2 marks, what do the following mean? Dillis Powell, prosciutto, prosciutto.
It's a kind of ham.
And what kind of ham?
It's not cooked ham. It isn't sort of boiled.
No. What is
you eat it with melon or with figs.
But what is done to it before? You don't eat it absolutely raw.
It's cured.
Yes.
What's wrong with it?
Prosciutto is Italian smoked ham, sometimes called Parma ham, and sometimes eaten with melon. 2 marks. Dennis Norton, bel paese.
It's a cheese.
Colour?
Well, it's a sort of creamy white.
Yep.
And they give you great dollops of it.
Quite right. A mild and creamy Italian white cheese. 2 marks. Anne Scott James, assiette anglaise.
Ah, it's one of those yummy mixtures of cold meats, I think.
It simply in French means a plate of assorted cold meats, which is presumably supposed to be the only thing that the English will eat.
It's really, yes, when you just sling a bit of ham and tongue at your guest.
That's right.
You call it assiette anglaise.
Frank Muir, Wiener Schnitzel.
This is a hot meal. It's like a half a leather wallet. which is dusted with fried sawdust, and on top are two slices of Lot's wife, arranged diagonally, and a dead olive, and it's all fried in sump oil, and I believe originally from Vienna. If it's Holstein, it's got a tired egg on it.
Do you think they're going to let you cross the Austrian border after this racket? Great mistake. I'm bound to give you your marks, even if your comments were not very nice. A thin veal cutlet coated with egg and breadcrumbs, fried and garnished with lemon, anchovies, and stoned olives, and comes from Vienna. And now we come to the last round and go back to the quotations I gave the two teams earlier in the program. So for 2 marks, Lewis Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation? Healing is a matter of time.
Some medical gentleman.
Yes.
A classical medical gentleman.
Classical medical gentleman.
Aesculapius, Hippocrates.
Yes, well, you better stick to the men and not the god.
Oh, Hippocrates, then.
Quite right. Hippocrates, the great Greek physician, who said healing is a matter of time, and he went on to say, but it's sometimes also a matter of opportunity. 2 marks. Anne Scott-James, the origin of your quotation, I dream of Jeannie with the light brown hair.
Well, I think that's a jolly old song.
Yes, it's a jolly old song.
Which Dennis will now sing you the tune.
Not without my group. Stephen Foster, I believe.
Yes, you're quite right. 2 marks. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir and his quotation, healing is a matter of time.
When I was young, I was known as Feckless Frank, the maddest madcap of all our crowd. It's funny, you know, that my old chums, they asked me how, after that zany, mad time we had in Buckinghamshire, how I could possibly live in a dull West London suburb. And we were crazy. We just didn't know what we were going to do next. When we were young, in a village, you know Aylesbury? Well, it was about a little village about 6 miles southwest of Aylesbury in a hollow called Thame, Tame. I lived with my aunt there, in between the two hills. It was a mad weald. So lots of us in the gang. There was Angela Moore Thaxton, and I was rather keen on her. And there was Colin Watts, and there was Elspeth Longbottom, a tall girl, and there was a... And my chum, Hugo Willoughby Gotch. Rather curious chap, but his mother was a fellow. the zoo, I think. Anyway, we all... we were so crazy in this village. It really was so exciting. There was always something going on. We used to play games, these mad games, like we'd have a competition as to which of the chaps would pull most pigtails in a day. You know, and I won, I pulled 17, you know. I just didn't care. Some of them were big pigs, some of them, too. And we'd have mad things like champagne suppers. And then came the day that Auntie died. I couldn't stay in my mad, wonderful Tame, and I moved and took a bachelor flat just at the back of the parade in West Ealing, nowhere near the common, of course. And I kept up my rugger. We all had the scarves, you know, and we watched the game on television, and then we all went round to the pub and whistled dirty songs in the saloon bar. We just didn't care what we did. It was really a terribly exciting time, and I suddenly realised that I was having a fuller life, even. My whole life was becoming gayer and more exciting. When people say, how could you leave mad Buckinghamshire for a London suburb? I say, but it's even better if you're in with the right crowd. In fact, if you are in with the right crowd, in the words of Hippocrates, Ealing is a Madua tame.
Well, writs will be served tomorrow by the mayor and the chairman of the Rural District Council, but never mind. We'll go on to Dennis Norden. And if we remember
his... served on you, it's urban district.
We'll go on to Dennis Norden. And if we remember, his quotation was, "I dream of Jeannie with the light brown hair."
Every step of that terrible journey, I kept saying to myself, what are you... the most timid, introverted people doing walking across London on a crowded Sunday afternoon, clad only in a short Japanese kimono with a dragon on the back? Why are you doing this? And then I answered myself, it's because of this urge of yours to be with it, which was exactly the reason why it happened. The previous week, I'd been taken to a discotheque for the first time. These cellars where they put on records of beat music and all the younger, smart people twitch and shake. And I suddenly realized I was the only man there in plus fours. Everybody else was wearing jeans. And that's what I must get. So the following Saturday morning, I went to this mecca of contemporary masculine styling called Carnaby Street, and the assistant approached me with the shaggiest head of hair I've ever seen outside of a yak. this very shaggy young man said to me, "What would you like, sir?" And I said, "I'd like a pair of jeans." And he said, "What colour, sir?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm not really particular. You know, what's all the go now? What's all the rage?" And he said, "Well, what they're wearing, what the chaps are wearing, is fawn at the moment, very, very sort of light brown." I said, "Well, they're there." So he fetched them out for me, and I tried them on. Now, I must point out to the vast unseen audience that I'm very tall, and I have terribly skinny legs from the waist down, the sort of in silhouette. It's rather like a wishbone. And that these jeans sort of hung around each shank in folds, rather like a sort of draped flag, which wasn't the effect I'd seen at all at the discotheque. And I said, "These don't fit, do they?" So he said, "No, well, that's all right." He said, "What you do is you shrink them." So I said, "Well, how do you shrink them?" He said, "You go and lay in the bath for 2 hours with them on." I said, "Billy, all right." So I went straight back home, and I laid in the bath for 2 hours, and I got up and looked, and there was absolutely no change at all. So I went straight back to the shop, and I looked out this young Harry, and I said, "No change at all." And he was very surprised, and he said, "What temperature was the water?" And I said, "Water. Oh, I see." I went back again, and I filled up the bath, and it was marvellous. It really was. They were absolutely moulded to me. And I thought, great, well, I'll take them off, and I'll put them in the oven to dry, and, you know, they'll be ready for the next night out. And I went to take them off. Now, that's where the trouble started. Because on these kind of jeans, the only means of entrance and exit is by means of a zip down the front, which is made of metal. Now, you don't have to be all that scientific to know the effect of 2 hours immersion in water on cheap metal. Rusted. Solid. I couldn't move at all. Couldn't get out of them in any way. And as you can imagine, I didn't pass a very comfortable night that night. Well, first thing Sunday morning, I called a cab and I went to the outpatients department of St. George's Hospital. And I said, "Could you possibly get me out of these?" Well, they were terribly nice about it. Apparently they get about 10 cases a day, it appears. And they sent for a skin specialist, and he used one of these electric scalpels, and I was rid of them. Except I'd neglected to bring a spare pair of trousers with me. So I said, could you possibly let me have a pair of trousers to go back home in? And he said, not on the National Health. Well, I don't know what I've done. If it hadn't been for this nice nurse who said, well, we do have some clothes here from the Hospital Amateur Dramatic Society's next production. Well, as you guessed, that was the Mikado. That was why I found myself walking across London on a Sunday afternoon in this short Japanese kimono with a dragon on the back. It's an experience I shall never forget, and for the rest of my life, I shall wake up twitching and sweating whenever I dream of Harry with the light brown jeans.
I think Dennis had a very lucky escape. And by your vote, he wins the contest of the two stories. And that brings us to a final score in which Dennis and Anne Scott James win by one mark from Dillis Powell and Frank Muir. And it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.